Chapter 12. The Studies and Observations Group. The Walter Reed amputee ward was a devastating sight to behold. Billy Waugh was now one of its patients, his right leg in a cast. The infection wasn't getting any better, and the doctor said part of his leg would likely need to be amputated, cut off below the knee. Day in and day out, Waugh watched fellow soldiers in the ward come and go. They'd get wheeled away to surgical rooms and return without an arm or a leg. The way Waugh saw it, there were two categories of amputees. Some soldiers became a shell of their former selves after they lost a limb. Others somehow managed to keep things light, like the sergeant major in the next bed over, who recently had his lower leg removed. Waugh went with him to the Friday night dance. "Watch this," the sergeant major said, unhooking his prosthetic leg and putting it on backward so the foot faced in reverse. The soldier with the prosthetic asked a pretty girl to dance, and she said sure, but while they were dancing, she looked down at his backward foot, screamed, and ran away. The sergeant major howled with laughter. Waugh didn't know which was worse, to lose a limb or to find humor in it. Soon enough, Dr. Arthur Metz, chief of lower extremity amputation surgery, came to give Billy Waugh the bad news. Despite two surgeries and 4 weeks of antibiotics, the infection in his right leg had gotten worse. Dr. Metz proposed amputating the foot from the ankle down. If it got any worse, they might have to take the bottom half of the leg. Waugh could not bear the thought. "I had it in my mind to return to combat," he says. "In 1965, you couldn't fight without a foot." Billy Waugh pleaded with Dr. Metz to be discharged. He wanted to go heal at his sister's house in Texas. Dr. Metz agreed and wrote him convalescent leave orders. Waugh was thrilled at first, but as he prepared to travel to Texas, hope gave way to misery. He missed being a soldier and the intensity of war. Something came over him and, penicillin bottle in hand, he decided to hitchhike to Vietnam as a standby passenger on military aircraft. It seemed like the pilots felt sorry for him with his long cast on his right leg, and he never had to wait long. In less than a week, he made it from Washington, D.C. to Travis Air Force Base outside San Francisco, to the Philippines, and finally to Tan Son Nhat Airport in Saigon. Saigon was a busy city in the summer of 1965. Waugh checked into the Hotel Majestic and headed to the Tudo Bar down the street, the place where soldiers went for rest and relaxation. It didn't take long for Waugh to spot two friends from Special Forces, Billy Kessinger, a medic, and Danny Horton, a communications man. Seated at a corner table, the trio of Green Berets began chatting. After a few beers, Kessinger and Horton hinted to Waugh about a highly classified direct action unit that was just now expanding. An elite, unconventional warfare group that was secreted inside MACV. No one outside the unit knew about it. It was a special access, covert program called the Studies and Observations Group, SOG. Named to deceive people into thinking its members were Ivy League-type analysts reading reports. In reality, the missions were so dangerously insane, Kessinger and Horton said. The acronym was translated to suicide on the ground by some guys. Kessinger and Horton were already in SOG, and they showed Waugh their credentials, a photo, a few coded letters, and a telephone number that you could call 24/7 if you needed anything. SOG members had unprecedented authority. They could go anywhere in South Vietnam at any time of the night or day, no getting stopped by military police, MP. If you were in SOG, you were authorized to carry a firearm at all times. Kessinger and Horton called the creds a wow pass because you could walk on water with it. Sitting and drinking at the Tudo bar, the men talked late into the night, past curfew for American soldiers. When an American MP approached the table and asked for identification, Kessinger and Horton flashed their wow passes. Waugh pulled a piece of paper from his pocket, unfolded it, and showed the MP his convalescent leave orders. "What the hell are you doing on convalescent leave in Vietnam, Master Sergeant William D. Waugh?" the MP asked, reading from the papers. "I'm visiting with my amigos," said Waugh. The MP was not certain what to make of this situation, so he called his commanding officer, who asked if Master Sergeant Waugh was causing problems. The MP said he wasn't. The commanding officer said convalescent leave orders were good, and Waugh could be left alone. The night ended without incident. A week later, Waugh returned to America, more determined than ever to get himself assigned to this classified, unconventional warfare unit called SOG. In Washington, D.C., he traveled to the Pentagon to meet with the assignments officer for Special Forces, a woman named Billie Alexander. Seated across from her, Waugh pleaded to be assigned to MAC V. SOG. All she could do was laugh, he recalls. She said, "I could barely walk. How did I expect to ever fight again?" Waugh proposed a challenge. If he was able to convince Dr. Metz to reassign him to Special Forces at Fort Bragg, and if he could last there for a month of training, would Billie Alexander recommend him for SOG? "Perhaps she felt sorry for me," Waugh remembers, "because she looked at me for a while, and then she said yes." Waugh met with Dr. Metz, who rejected his idea. His lower leg was beyond salvage, Metz said, and required amputation. Waugh begged to undergo one last exploratory surgery. The doctor agreed. During the surgery, Dr. Metz went far up into the leg, near the knee, where he located a tiny sliver of Waugh's army boot lodged inside the tibia. This was the likely source of the months-long infection. Once it was removed, the final round of penicillin took hold, and Waugh began to heal. The following month, he returned to Fort Bragg. In his second week back in Special Forces, he received new orders. He was being sent to Vietnam as part of MAC V. SOG. The reason for SOG's highly classified nature was that it violated the Geneva Agreement of 1962, the Declaration on the Neutrality of Laos, which forbade U.S. forces from operating inside the country. But at the Pentagon, after almost 2 years of reading reports from intelligence assets in the field, the Defense Department was coming around to the idea that Laos was the key to the insurgency and the Ho Chi Minh Trail the locus of the problem. Now, President Johnson needed convincing. The initial job of SOG reconnaissance men would be to sneak into Laos, take photographs of activity on the trail, plant listening devices, and get out alive with the evidence. Eventually, they would be assigned cross-border missions into Cambodia as well. "Nobody knew with certainty what was in Laos," says John Plaster, a former member of the classified unit. Learning what was there was SOG's new operation. Plaster is considered one of the most competent snipers in U.S. military history, and his experiences in MAC V. SOG would later serve as the basis for part of the video game Call of Duty Black Ops. SOG's first chief was Colonel Donald Blackburn, the former leader of Operation White Star, and he prepared his fighters for battles in Laos that would be decidedly ungentlemanly. Blackburn was a master of guerrilla warfare. During World War II, he led kill or be killed missions in the Philippines, where the tribesmen he organized into a guerrilla fighting force turned out to be headhunters. Blackburn's Wartime Diary became a best-selling book in 1955 called Blackburn's Headhunters. In Laos, SOG operators would need to employ ruthless, unconventional warfare tactics with unmerciful intensity. To direct SOG operations on the ground, Colonel Blackburn chose another guerrilla warfare legend, the Finnish-born Larry Thorne. MACV SOG started out with just 16 volunteers, all Green Berets who'd been training on Okinawa. The men worked out of a forward operating base in Cam Duc, a border village located 60 miles southwest of Da Nang. Similar to the Civilian Irregular Defense Group program and the OSS Jedburghs before that, each SOG team was made up of two or three American soldiers and nine tribesmen. Initially, the tribesmen were Hmong, an ethnic Chinese minority. Later, they included Montagnards, indigenous people from Vietnam's central highlands, whom the Americans called Yards. We Americans had advanced technology, such as helicopters, and the tribesmen had ancient techniques, such as silent ambush, explains John Plaster. The tribesmen helped the Green Berets understand the tactics that were being used by the NVA guerrilla fighters, things not found in any manual. For example, Hmong tribesmen demonstrated how, by digging a 4-foot hole into a hillside, a fighter could see and feel the vibrations of an advancing aircraft long before his ears registered the engine sound. Shared tricks of the trade went both ways. Tribesmen were also recruited to watch and count enemy troops and supplies being moved through the jungle. Because most could not read or write English or Vietnamese, the CIA's technical staff developed a non-literate system of conveyance. Instead of words, the counting devices given out to recruits featured tiny pictograms representing men, weapons, vehicles, even elephants, a common means of transport in the region. When the recruits activated a toggle switch on the device, their data was transmitted to CIA aircraft flying overhead. Unlike the CIDG program, the bond between the tribesmen and the SOG operators was reported to be strong. The Hmong and Yards could have cared less about South Vietnam as a country, recalls Plaster. They felt no allegiance to some abstract paymaster like the United States, but they were ready to die for their recon teammates, American and Yard alike. SOG's first cross-border mission into Laos occurred on October 18, 1965. U.S. Ambassador William Sullivan forbade SOG from using helicopter insertions into the supposedly neutral country, so the first team to go in, Reconnaissance Team, RT Iowa, was inserted by helicopter on the Vietnam side of the border. They walked through the jungle into Laos. The team leader, or 1-0, was Master Sergeant Charles Slats Petrie. The assistant team leader, or 1-1, was Sergeant First Class Willie Card. Together, these two Americans led seven Hmong mercenaries and one lieutenant from the South Vietnamese Army, ARVN, to gather reconnaissance of enemy activity along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Rather than oversee the mission from Cam Duc, Larry Thorne flew with his men in the helicopter, circling overhead, until he received word they'd successfully crossed over into Laos. Each SOG team wore Asian-made uniforms with no labels or insignia. They carried sterile weapons, meaning they came with no identifying marks, such as the Swedish K submachine gun, and they smoked Chinese cigarettes. If anyone got captured in Laos, no one could identify them as Americans. SOG operators were issued unmarked V-42 stiletto knives with 6-inch blades, designed by Ben Barker on Okinawa and secretly manufactured in Japan. Not since the days of the OSS had the U.S. military issued stiletto knives. Overhead air support was critical to the success of every mission. The H-34 King B helicopter was SOG's signature aircraft, a bubble-nosed workhorse able to withstand a hail of automatic weapons fire and keep flying. The King Bs were flown by South Vietnamese Air Force pilots trained in Texas by the CIA. With radio call signs like Cowboy and Mustachio, these pilots saved countless SOG men from capture or death, performing radical jungle infiltration, exfiltration, and rescue operations day after day. All gave some gave all, says SOG operator John Stryker Meyer of the King Bee pilots. Cessna aircraft were also used regularly on missions, and flying on the first mission in a Cessna 02 spotter were U.S. Air Force Major Harley Piles and U.S. Marine Corps Captain Winfield Sisson. If anything went wrong, the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Navy were on standby, ready to send in covert air support in the form of overhead airstrikes. RT Iowa was inserted successfully, and after a few hours, they radioed Larry Thorne to say they'd crossed the border into Laos. Thorne radioed Cam Duk to say he was now heading back to base. He was never heard from again. In the first few minutes of SOG's classified border operations, the program swallowed up one of its finest officers and a whole King Bee helicopter, says John Plaster. That afternoon, the Cessna, carrying Major Piles and Captain Sisson, disappeared. On SOG's first mission, 3 men went missing in action, MIA, never to be seen again. It was an indication of the kind of catastrophic loss SOG would face over the next 6 years. The great majority of such cases are either still classified or lack records, said to have been lost. Over the next 8 months, 5 SOG recon teams working out of Cam Duk conducted 48 cross-border missions. In the winter of 1966, MACV headquarters opened a second SOG base up north at Quezon, closer to the demilitarized zone, DMZ. Still limping from 5 gunshot wounds to the leg, Billy Waugh arrived there in May. Located in the northwest corner of South Vietnam, Quezon was the most remote American military facility in all of the South, a strip of flat land surrounded by 4,000-foot mountains and treacherous ravines. Much of the activity centered around Co Rock Mountain, a 2,000-foot limestone peak visible from the base, as were Hill 1050 and Hill 950, veritable beehives of NVA activity. The geography here was unlike anything in the United States. Endless karst limestone outcroppings that looked like giant vine-covered chimneys. The base camp, under the control of the U.S. Marine Corps, was strategically located just 14 miles south of the DMZ and 12 miles east of the border with Laos. For SOG, this meant that Quezon was within striking distance of key enemy bases along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The SOG base at Quezon was a special access facility, partitioned behind concertina wire, surrounded by blast walls, and built mostly underground. SOG operations were classified, which meant that even Quezon's Marine commander, Colonel David E. Lowndes, wasn't privy to its activities. In 1966, when Waugh arrived, the new SOG chief was Jack Singlob, the former OSS Jedburgh who ran covert CIA airdrop operations during the Korean War under the cover name Joint Advisory Commission Korea, or JAK. There was no rest at SOG, remembers Billy Waugh, only war, recon, rescue, sleep. International law meant nothing to the enemy out here on the border region between Vietnam and Laos, a concept SOG men were regularly forced to grapple with. Despite the covert nature of their missions, Special Forces soldiers operated under the U.S. military chain of command and were bound by the laws of war. Ever since the Libor Code of 1863, the execution of captured prisoners and the mutilation of dead soldiers' bodies on the battlefield was expressly forbidden. The 1949 Geneva Conventions updated these protocols for the modern era. And yet, look what the NVA had done to Sergeant Donald Sane, thought Billy Waugh, as he flew over Co-Rock Mountain in a SOG observation aircraft. It was June 1966. R.T. Montana had been ambushed 3 days before, with two SOG men captured and executed, and seven Indig killed in action, KIA, or missing in action, MIA. 10 Henry Whalen made it back to Quezon and gave the ambush location coordinates to SOG commanders. Waugh was put in charge of a rescue or retrieval mission, which is why he was across the border in Laos now, searching for dead bodies from the Cessna. When he spotted Sergeant Donald Sane's body in a jungle clearing, he felt contempt and disgust. Don Sane was a 23-year-old kid from Santa Clara County, California, who'd worn a white tuxedo and a bow tie to prom just a few years before. Now, he was not just dead, but had been mutilated and put on display by the NVA. Sane's captors had killed him and arranged him in a spread eagle position, with his legs staked to the earth and his arms tied to a tree. Maggots were crawling around the gunshot wounds that Don Sane had taken to the chest. Once vibrant and full of life, he was now carrion. It was 9 a.m. and Waugh assessed the situation. I'd been in combat long enough to know Sane's body was not only displayed so we could see it, but it had to be booby-trapped as well, he recalls. Waugh instructed the pilot to head back to the SOG base at Quezon. There, he briefed his commanding officer. After putting together a bright light rescue team, the SOG men returned to the clearing in the jungle. The team included Danny Horton, the communications man from the Tudo Bar, Sergeant First Class James Craig, a medic, and Major Gerald Jerry Kilburn, the most senior officer in the group, and a POW during the Korean War. Flying the H-34 King Bee was South Vietnamese Air Force pilot Nguyen Van Hoang, call sign Mustachio, so named after the Clark Gable-style mustache he wore. Once, during a rescue operation and under heavy fire, Mustachio was struck in the neck with a bullet while piloting a King Bee over a target. He plugged the bullet hole with his fingers and got the crippled helicopter 20 kilometers back to Quezon, flying with only one hand. With Mustachio at the controls, the King Bee hovered over Sane's body. While Waugh tried to figure out how to get a hold of it without being hit by grenade frag, Mustachio searched for a landing zone. NVA were everywhere, and time was critical. Body retrieval was the perfect time for an ambush. Mustachio circled around a few times before setting the King Bee down, roughly 100 meters from the body. The rescue team hopped off. Approaching the body, Billy Waugh felt the anger and disgust return. The stench of rotting flesh was hard to bear. He grabbed a climbing rope and told Major Kilburn his plan. I decided to tie one end of the rope to the wheel of Mustachio's helicopter and the other end around Sane's leg. That way, we'd move the body and let the booby traps explode harmlessly, Wah recalls. The team looked at Wah like he was crazy. There was no manual for this kind of horrid shit, he says. The rope was the fastest and most efficient way to achieve the objective. Wah tied the rope to the helicopter wheel and instructed Mustachio to hover over Sane. Delicately, so as not to set off the grenades, he tied the rope around Sane's leg. Let's move out, he told the team. Everyone stepped back a few yards. Using the helicopter, Mustachio pulled the body off the ground. Three or four booby-trap grenades started going off around Sane. Sane was hovering above us by his leg, remembers Wah. The fluids and maggots and crap from his body poured out as he was being lifted up and away, and as it did, Kilburn got sprayed with debris. Kilburn, a highly decorated combat veteran, had sustained 3 years of torture at the hands of his communist captors in the Korean War, but this was too much for him. When the fluids hit Kilburn, he screamed. Mustachio lifted Sane's body and set it down. Kilburn finished screaming. Everyone got quiet. Sane's body had been recovered, but there was more work to do. A second SOG man from RT Montana was still missing, a kid from Missouri named Sergeant Delmer Lee Outlaw Laws. The Brightlight team searched the area, trying to find a blood trail and maybe find Laws. The SOG men divvied up ground, each man assigned a quadrant to scour. This part of the jungle was hostile and unforgiving, filled with poisonous snakes like the two-step snake. If it bit you, you had 2 steps left in you before you died. Wah found himself waist-high in wait-a-minute bushes, prickly plants with claws the sharpness of a cat's that hooked into your skin when you passed by. If you got snagged, you had to wait a minute to unhook yourself or get torn to shreds. After several hours of searching, everyone's fatigues were ripped up, arms and faces scratched up and bleeding. But no one was ready to stop yet. They intended to find Outlaw. Danny Horton called out. He'd found a blood trail. Wah saw Horton emerge from the woods, looking ill. In one hand, he carried an American jungle boot. Something grotesque was sticking out of the shoe, recalls Wah, and he figured out he was looking at part of Delmer Law's leg. Danny Horton took the group to where he'd found it. He'd been mostly eaten by a tiger, says Wah. The ride back to the SOG base was quiet. Beneath the helicopter, Sane's body was swinging from a rope. Delmer Law's leg was lying on the floor of the helicopter in a plastic body bag. Once they landed on the tarmac at Quezon, Billy Wah climbed out of the helicopter, carrying Law's leg in the bag. My clothes were shredded. I was filthy, covered in horrible things. My arms and face were scratched. I smelled, he recalls. Standing there on the tarmac, waiting for the SOG Brightlight team, was an officer from the 5th Special Forces. Taking a break from his desk duties at MACV headquarters in Nha Trang, remembers Wah. He asked me to come inside. Wah followed his superior officer into the SOG base. The officer began yelling at him. God damn it, Wah, he said. You're filthy, you smell, and you're out of uniform. You're a disgrace, all of you. Wah set the plastic bag on the table. He took a moment before he spoke. Every soldier knows chain of command. Every soldier respects authority. Your superior officer is always correct. But Wah could not contain himself. He took Law's leg out of the body bag and set it on the table. How about him? Wah asked, pointing. Is he a disgrace? The officer stared at the jungle boot and the bloody stump. What the hell is that? He asked. It's Sergeant Delmer Lee Law's leg, said Wah. The rest of him got eaten by a tiger. Is he out of uniform, sir? The officer grew quiet, apologized, and left. The following week, a box arrived at Quezon from headquarters in Nha Trang. Inside, there were three boxes of crisp, new jungle fatigues. No markings, of course. No one could know the SOG operators were violating the Declaration on the Neutrality of Laos. Chapter 13, Kill or Capture. After the assassination of President Kennedy in November of 1963, President Johnson renamed the special group Augmented the 303 Committee. Assassination plots against foreign leaders appeared to have been toned down, or at least the president's inner circle of advisors stopped allowing the minutes of the meetings in which they were discussed to be recorded. The exception was with plans to kill Fidel Castro and Che Guevara, which moved ahead full bore. In 1967, the CIA Inspector General ordered an internal report on its assassination capability, the working papers of which were then destroyed on the orders of CIA Director Richard Helms. At least one significant assassination plan was likely part of the destroyed cache, an extraordinarily sensitive mission to kill General Giap, the indomitable leader of the North Vietnamese Army. Giap was to visit an NVA command center in supposedly neutral Laos, a sovereign nation. The group chosen to kill him was Mac V. Sog. One of the first two men to the target area was to be Billy Waugh. It was June 2, 1967, and Billy Waugh was summoned to a briefing inside SOG headquarters at Quezon. Something unprecedented was about to happen, he was told, a direct action operation so important that all the other air-supported missions across Vietnam would come to a halt. Over the previous 24 hours, the CIA and the Pentagon had intercepted roughly 1,500 communiques between Hanoi and an NVA stronghold located just a few miles from Quezon inside Laos. The area had been given a code name, Oscar 8. Analysis of the intercepted messages confirmed that Oscar 8 was the secret NVA field headquarters the CIA had been trying to locate for months. The CIA sent its U-2 spy planes overhead in search of photographic intelligence. Images confirmed enemy traffic along the lower portion of the Ho Chi Minh Trail was being diverted to Oscar 8. Then came a reconnaissance coup d'etat, signals intelligence intercepted by the U.S. Army, indicated that General Giap himself was headed to Oscar 8 for a meeting. Billy Waugh would act as forward air controller in charge of observation and relay for the mission. At 4 a.m. the next morning, he'd fly in over the target in a Cessna and circle overhead for the duration of the mission, high enough to avoid NVA anti-aircraft fire, but low enough to watch through binoculars what was unfolding on the ground. It would be Waugh's job to relay information to the various parties involved via SOG's communication system, serving as a kind of battle coordinator in the sky. The mission plan was succinct. 9 B-52 bombers would fly in over the target to drop 900 bombs, each 200 pounds, a means of inflicting damage on the enemy camp and obliterating its capacity to respond. 14 minutes later, two Marine helicopter gunships would strafe the area, clearing a landing zone, LZ. Next, two troop transport helicopters, piloted by Marine Corps pilots, would deposit two teams of SOG hatchet forces, large 30- or 40-man units used in big operations. Air support would come from two Sky Raider aircraft, propeller-driven workhorses that were slow but effective. Two King Bee helicopters would insert two 9-man SOG teams, experienced operators tasked with locating and killing General Zhap. Finally, four fast-flying F-4 Phantom fighter jets would provide close air support. SOG had 7 hours to kill or capture General Zhap and get out. But Oscar 8 was a defender's dream. The bowl-shaped valley was surrounded by hills on three sides, forming a strategic ridge-shaped horseshoe. On earlier recon missions, SOG teams reported seeing 12.7-millimeter anti-aircraft artillery, called AAA, scattered on hilltops and platforms in the jungle canopy like hunting blinds. Now it was dawn at Khe Sanh. Billy Waugh climbed into the Cessna 02 spotter aircraft, into the seat beside the pilot, James Alexander, an Air Force major. They flew 8 miles out from Khe Sanh, over the jungle canopy and into Laos, becoming the first to survey the Oscar 8 target area. Waugh had been in combat missions in Vietnam, off and on, since 1961, and he thought to himself, this day could change the war. The Pentagon had determined General Zhap to be an even greater source of morale to fighters than Ho Chi Minh himself. Killing Zhap could end the war. Through binoculars, Waugh spotted cook fires down below, soldiers up early preparing breakfast for the fighters, he surmised. Major Alexander moved the Cessna roughly 15 miles to the south, where he began to circle overhead in anticipation of the B-52 bombers soon to arrive. Waugh checked his watch. It was 4:45. The sun was coming up and the sky was purple and orange. Above and in the distance, Waugh spotted the contrails of the B-52s. Like clockwork, at 6 a.m., 9 B-52 bombers passed over Oscar 8, inundating the target area with 200-pound bombs. It was a colossal attack, one that left the surrounding valley seemingly destroyed. Waugh observed how the land below was now pockmarked with hundreds of apartment building-sized bomb craters, burned-out, smoking holes. Through binoculars, he watched weapons depots explode and burn. Grass sleep shacks had been set ablaze, and scores of enemy fighters were rushing out from makeshift buildings, hurrying to put out fires. He watched fighters remove weapons from burning boxes and roll gasoline barrels out of the way. Overhead, as the B-52s made a second pass, suddenly, something entirely unexpected happened. The ridges around Oscar 8 lit up. NVA soldiers down below were firing back with a barrage of anti-aircraft fire. How could this be, thought Waugh. The camp had been heavily bombed, and yet the NVA air defenses appeared to be entirely intact. The B-52 bombers flew too high for the NVA to hit with anti-aircraft fire, but the SOG helicopters that were about to come in would be vulnerable to direct fire. Concerned with the speed and aggression of the NVA gunners' response, Waugh picked up the radio and called the Marine helicopter gunship pilots who'd soon be heading into the target area. They needed to turn around immediately. Abort this mission, Waugh shouted. Abort! No answer, nothing but silence over the comms. Waugh tried again. Then he tried contacting the Marine pilots who were flying the CH-46 troop transport helicopters, each one packed with 30 SOG hatchet forces. No answer, silence, shit. Did everybody switch VHF channels? Waugh asked Major Alexander. Major Alexander shook his head and tried his own commo. Nothing but radio silence on his, too. Waugh checked his watch. The helicopters delivering the hatchet forces were scheduled to arrive 14 minutes after the first B-52 bombing run, which meant any minute now. Desperate to get in touch with someone, Waugh kept trying his radio, but it was too late. Below and to the east, he spotted two Marine helicopter gunships flying in fast and low. They began strafing the target area, clearing the LZ for the hatchet forces to land. Waugh and Alexander watched in horror as one of the gunships was picked off by NVA ground fire. Then the second helicopter was hit. The two helicopters each began to wobble and spin, then crashed into the landing zone almost side by side. The sight of the twin helicopter crashes sent adrenaline coursing through Waugh's body. He had to get the CH-46 on the radio. Those hatchet forces could not land. It was suicide, he thought. He tried the UHF radio, then the VHF radio again. "Do not land," he shouted. "Abort. Hatchet forces, do not land." All this high technology and nobody could hear anything. But the landings were now in progress, and Waugh watched helplessly as the CH-46s entered the target area. Double rotors spinning, one in front, one in back, like two school buses in the sky, he thought. Based on the angle at which they were flying in, the CH-46 pilots would be unable to see the crashed helicopters until after it was too late. Waugh and Alexander were both shouting into their radios, "Abort! Abort!" The helicopters were now roughly 70 feet above the ground, side by side, over the landing zone. Through binoculars, Waugh could see into one of them. The door was open, and dozens of men were inside, amped up and ready to deploy. He'd been in that position countless times, standing in the doorway before the helicopter even landed, waiting to hit the ground running. He knew precisely how charged they had to be when, hovering now only 50 feet above the ground, the helicopter was hit with anti-aircraft fire. It appeared to split in half. Waugh watched as the SOG men tumbled out of the aircraft and began falling like stones to the ground. It was impossible to survive that kind of fall. Waugh felt ill. The second helicopter was now 40 feet over the landing zone when it, too, was hit with anti-aircraft fire and split open. Waugh watched some of the men inside fall out and down. Others hung on to anything they could. The helicopter spun and maintained some of its lift, crash landing in a way that left Waugh thinking there might be survivors. Straining to see through the binoculars, he counted 9, possibly 10 men alive. He watched as they scrambled out of the burning aircraft and ran. Training taught them to take cover in the jungle, to evade and escape. In came the two H-34 King Bee helicopters carrying the SOG teams assigned to kill Jop. One was raked with enemy gunfire. Waugh watched as it burst into flames, then crashed into the ground. Through binoculars, he saw 3 crew members inside scramble out of the burning helicopter and take cover. One SOG operator was shot dead as he ran, but the other 2 appeared to have made it into the jungle. Waugh kept his eyes on the SOG men as they evaded capture. They were definitely alive and definitely running for cover, he noted. The second helicopter appeared to have landed. As Waugh strained to see, Major Alexander moved the Cessna up to 4,000 feet, where the comm channels might be better, and as he did, Waugh briefly lost sight of what was happening on the ground. Up at 4,000 feet, the radio worked, and Waugh reached Major Kilburn at the SOG facility at Quezon. Kilburn knew nothing about what was happening at the target area. "We got a real problem here at Oscar 8, Waugh said, and he relayed the dire situation as quickly and succinctly as he could. The mission to kill or capture General Jop was now a rescue mission, Kilburn said. The goal was to try and get anyone trapped inside Oscar 8 out of there alive. As Hua discussed the situation with Major Kilburn, two Phantom fighter jets screeched in over the valley at Mach 2. Hua watched, stunned, as anti-aircraft fire hit one of the fast-moving jets in the right wing near the fuel tank. The silver Phantom exploded in the air. "Come on, parachute," Hua wished out loud as the jet spiraled down. No parachute. The Phantom jet crashed into the hillside and exploded. "Sky Raiders coming in," someone said over the comms, startling him. "They think they can take out the AAA. Hua shook his head. This was suicide. He and Major Alexander watched as two A-1E Sky Raider propeller aircraft came in low and slow. Sky Raiders fly 110 miles per hour. And in this scenario, they were sitting ducks. With an explosion of fire, each of them was hit by anti-aircraft fire and crashed violently into the hillside below. "It's a graveyard down there," Major Alexander said. Through binoculars, Hua watched as enemy fighters on the ground swarmed to the downed aircraft. He tried again to make radio contact with any of those who'd gone down, but no one responded to his calls. The Cessna was running low on fuel. Soon they'd have to turn back. Hua called over the radio again. Nothing, not a sound. Then, suddenly, Hua's radio crackled to life. "This is Hatchet Force, on the ground," a faint voice said over the comms. "Incredible," thought Hua. "Hatchet Force, where are you?" he asked. "See the two red panels at the edge of the crater?" the SOG Hatchet Force operator asked. Through binoculars, Hua scanned the ground until he located a group of SOG men and yards gathered inside one of the bomb craters made by the B-52s just an hour or so earlier. "We need air support," the soldier said. "We're 25 alive." Unbelievable. But the men in the bomb crater were surrounded on all sides by hundreds of NVA. As Billy Hua and Major Alexander returned to Quezon to refuel, they pondered the question, how do you get 25 men out of a target area when you can't get any aircraft in? In the jungle outside Oscar 8, SOG operator Sergeant First Class Charles F. Wilklow crawled along on his belly, leaving behind a trail of blood as he went. Wilklow had been badly injured in the CH-46 helicopter crash, along with two other SOG men, four air crew, and 30 Montagnards, all of whom were now either killed or missing. After surviving the initial helicopter crash, Wilklow took cover inside a bomb crater with SOG operators Billy Ray Laney and Ron Dexter and roughly 20 Indige. The soldiers' injuries ranged from compound fractures to chest wounds, and at least 15 of them required immediate evacuation. From the crater, they watched as two SOG King Bee helicopters came in, preparing to load the most grievously injured onto the helicopters to get out. The first King Bee helicopter that was coming in took fire, crashed, and exploded in a fireball. But the second managed to land, Wilklow observed. The SOG operators, who'd been assigned to kill General Zhap, jumped out while the injured soldiers from the bomb crater were loaded inside. Wilklow crawled to the helicopter and climbed aboard before it took off. Under heavy fire, the King Bee lifted up and began to fly away. Hundreds of NVA bullets punched through the skin of the aircraft as it ascended. Then, just as the pilot got up over the jungle canopy, he took a bullet to the forehead and died. The helicopter lurched into a violent spin. For the second time that morning, Charlie Wilklow found himself in a helicopter crash. The chopper spun and landed in the trees, the thick jungle canopy keeping it from hitting the ground. Wilklow looked around. He was alive, but there were dead bodies everywhere. Pushing past the dead, and despite grievous injuries, he climbed down from the trees and began running. That's when an NVA bullet caught him in the leg. He crawled into hiding out of view, for now. Through the bushes, he saw that SOG operator Billy Ray Laney was dead from a shot to the chest. He watched Ron Dexter be captured and executed on the spot. A third SOG operator, Frank Sias Jr., was also captured, but for some reason, the NVA soldiers didn't kill him. They blindfolded Sias and marched him away. Wilklo lay silent in the bush. He was lightheaded from blood loss and without a weapon, having lost his Car 15 in the second helicopter crash. He could hear the NVA searching for him, but he'd found a place to hide. Finally, he passed out. When he woke up, he saw an NVA soldier in the trees staring down at him. The man had a 12.7mm machine gun trained on him and was smoking a cigarette. Wilklo passed out again. When he woke up the second time, there were a group of NVA soldiers around him. He figured he was done for. Back at the SOG base at Quezon, Staff Sergeant Lester Pace was at work on the tarmac, loading and unloading men as they came in. He watched Billy Waugh climb out of the Cessna and hurry down into the SOG bunker. Major Kilburn was holding a briefing inside. He quickly related the facts. 25 SOG men were alive in a B-52 bomb crater at Oscar 8, fighting to hold back an untold number of enemy forces. They would not last long without resupply, Major Kilburn said. He decided to have himself, with weapons and as much ammo as possible, inserted into the bomb crater immediately by King Bee helicopter so he could personally take charge of the situation and direct tactical airstrikes. Together with the 25 alive, Kilburn would hold off the NVA until a rescue operation could be launched, which would have to wait until after dusk. Waugh reported what he'd seen. Several SOG men had escaped into the jungle and were likely still alive. He volunteered to put a bright light rescue team together to search for anyone alive. Kilburn decided that sending in additional aircraft at this time of day was suicidal. Only the cover of darkness would change the calculus. It was barely 9 a.m. Waugh would have to wait until dusk to launch a rescue operation. Mustachio volunteered to fly Kilburn into the bomb crater at Oscar 8. Lester Pace loaded up the aircraft for the two men. It was a radical, risky infiltration operation, which Mustachio pulled off flawlessly. In what an after-action report listed as occurring in less than 90 seconds, Kilburn leapt out into the bomb crater, the SOG men unloaded the weapons and ammo, then loaded the 5 worst-wounded Indige into the helicopter, and finally signaled for Mustachio to get out. Back at the SOG base, the question on everyone's mind was, could the men left in the bomb crater last until dusk? In the jungle, Charlie Wilklo was awake again, thirsty beyond description, maggots crawling around his gaping leg wound. The group of NVA soldiers stood over him, staring down, a few with guns trained on him. The soldiers dragged Wilklo to a small camp adjacent to the Oscar 8 bowl. They assigned a guard to him, a strange-looking man whose face had been disfigured, leaving him with no nose, just 2 nostrils above the top lip. Every time Wilklo passed out, he experienced a terrible nightmare about his captor and his mutilated face. After depositing Kilburn in the bomb crater, Mustachio made it back to base with 5 gravely wounded yards. While Lester Pace unloaded the helicopter, Billy Waugh asked Mustachio how long until he was ready to go searching for missing SOG operators. Mustachio said he was ready now. It was 10 a.m. That's close enough to dusk, thought Waugh. Mustachio and Waugh headed back to Oscar 8, flying over it, outside the range of anti-aircraft fire, desperately searching for a sign of anyone who might be alive. Any combat soldier who has evaded capture and awaited rescue will tell you that there is nothing like the sound of helicopter rotor blades to sharpen the will to survive. These rescue operations were critical to morale, says John Plaster. The thought that your fellow SOG men would never give up a chance to look for you was why so many SOG operators were willing to keep running into battle despite highly unfavorable odds. Meanwhile, on the jungle floor outside Oscar 8, the group of NVA soldiers who'd captured Charlie Wilklow decided to use him as bait. Wilklow's lower leg was nearly destroyed. He was not going anywhere, so they laid him down in an open clearing and spread out his red rescue panel on his chest, hoping the SOG helicopter flying overhead would see him and come for him. But the jungle was endless, a sea of green trees, and neither Waugh nor Mustachio spotted Charlie Wilklow spread out on the ground with a signal panel on his chest. After dusk, Kilburn and the 20 men in the bomb crater were all extracted alive. But there were no survivors beyond that. 24 hours passed. The next day, Waugh and Alexander continued searching. Nothing. 48 hours passed, then 72. Still searching, still no missing men found. On the fourth day, on a pass over the western edge of the Horseshoe Ridge, Waugh noticed an unusual color on the jungle floor, red. He asked Major Alexander to fly in closer. My God, he thought, that's a red signal panel. There was a body down there with a signal panel across the chest. Waugh was certain of it. Waugh used the FM radio to call back to Quezon. He requested 2 SOG men and a helicopter for a rescue mission. All the SOG recon men were out on new missions. The only SOG man on base was Lester Pace, working resupply. Didn't matter. Waugh knew Pace to be a dedicated SOG man who also happened to be endowed with hellacious strength. I told him I needed him for a rescue mission, remembers Waugh. Pace said he was just about to leave for some rest and relaxation in Hong Kong. No, you're not, said Waugh. Of course I was going to go on the rescue mission, Pace recalled in an interview for this book. I'd already served my time in the jungle, spent 6 or 7 months on a SOG recon team. I knew everyone on base. Now in resupply, I'd get the guys anything they needed to complete a mission. I saw them go out, and I was aware who didn't return. Not wasting any time, Waugh briefed Pace on the rescue mission over the radio. He'd need to rappel down out of a hovering king bee wearing an extraction rig and carrying a second one. When you reach the man on the ground, said Waugh, hook him to yourself, give the pilot the thumbs up, and both of you will lift off. Pace said he understood. The helicopter pilot flew Lester Pace to the target area, loitering over the jungle canopy where the man and his red panel were last seen. I sensed nothing but danger, Pace recalled, all the danger in the world. The NVA were like the Tasmanian devil. They swarmed. They hid. They were everywhere. My gut feeling was, wow, this might be the end for me. With the pilot hovering over the target, Lester Pace leaned out of the helicopter for a better look. He saw the SOG man move. The man was definitely alive. Pace gave the pilot the signal he was going to go, then rappelled down toward the body. He hooked the soldier to the second rig, then gave the pilot the thumbs up. The pilot lifted the two men up off the ground and moved fast out of enemy territory. Wilklow grabbed and hugged me, remembered Pace. He said, "I don't believe this. I'm supposed to be dead." The pilot made it safely back to base. When they landed at Quezon with Charlie Wilklow, everyone just grabbed and hugged him, Pace recalls. Sergeant First Class Charlie Wilklow had survived two deadly helicopter crashes, been captured by the NVA, held as a POW, forgotten about, and then rescued, all against impossible odds. The NVA had set Wilklow up as bait and had prepared to ambush and kill or capture the SOG rescue team. But apparently, after 3.5 days, the NVA gave up on Wilklow being rescued and instead left him out in the open to die. Maggots that had infested Wilklow's wounds saved his leg and probably his life. The insects ate away the dead tissue and kept him from developing blood poisoning. After the war, Pace recalls driving on base at Fort Bragg. He saw a man walking along the side of the road and recognized him to be Charlie Wilklow. "I rolled down my window and introduced myself, told him who I was," remembers Pace. "He couldn't believe it. He invited me back to his place. His wife cooked a nice dinner, and he told her the whole story about how I saved his life." Pace retired from the U.S. Army Special Forces, moved to Brooklyn, New York, and worked as a school teacher for 25 years. He never told his family about any of his classified SOG missions. Lester Pace's son, Bakari Pace, found out about his dad's past in 2011. After the existence of SOG was finally declassified by the Defense Department and SOG members started sharing their experiences in forums online. The CIA had been watching Che Guevara's moves closely for 8 years. In the spring of 1967, he disappeared. Despite the CIA's reach and resources, they had no idea where he was. In Cuba, things had ended badly for Che Guevara. In a speech in 1965, he'd attacked the Soviet Union, calling its leaders state-run profiteers. He'd expressed outrage over the fact that the Soviet Union wasn't doing more to support small wars of liberation around the globe. Castro was unable to control Che's pro-war rhetoric, which included a call for nuclear war should it come about. Moscow put pressure on Fidel Castro to do something about him. The CIA intercepted a communique from Leonid Brezhnev warning that the activities of Ernesto Che Guevara were harmful to the true interests of the communist cause. Under pressure from his Soviet benefactors, Fidel Castro sent Che Guevara to Africa to start a revolution in Congo, which failed. In November 1966, Che Guevara left for Bolivia to try to start a revolution there. The handsome revolutionary was one of the most recognizable figures in the world, so he disguised himself as a middle-aged Uruguayan economist, wearing thick glasses and a skull cap that made him look bald. Before he left Cuba this last time, Che gave his wife, Alida, a letter to read to their children should he never return. "Grow up to be good revolutionaries," Che implored. "Remember that the revolution is what is important, and that each one of us on our own is worthless." Now it was the summer of 1967, and a deathly ill Che Guevara was holed up in the Bolivian mountains with a small band of Marxist revolutionaries who were in equally bad shape. Like men shipwrecked on an island, Che and his guerrilla fighters had barely anything to eat. When a local peasant shared his food with them, cooked pork, they were unable to digest the meat and got sick. Eventually, they slaughtered their own horses and mules. Emaciated from diarrhea and without asthma medicine, Che hadn't taken a bath in 6 months. The will to go on withered from him, he wrote in his diary. He felt depressed. The Bolivian army was after him. So was the CIA. In June 1967, in Miami, Florida, Felix Rodriguez received a call from his CIA case officer. Rodriguez had continued to work for the agency on contract operations ever since he was first recruited for Brigade 2506, the Bay of Pigs operation, in 1961. Then came a mysterious call. "Are you willing to go to Bolivia and lead a mission?" a man asked cryptically. Rodriguez learned that the job he was being offered required unconventional warfare skills and that it was an anti-guerrilla operation, a mission so highly classified it had been authorized by the President of the United States. The U.S. ambassador to Bolivia set forth a stipulation that the man chosen by the CIA to lead the covert operation needed to be a non-U.S. citizen. Felix Rodriguez was still a Cuban national. "What's the mission?" Rodriguez asked. "Train Bolivian Army Rangers in unconventional warfare and go get Che Guevara," he was told. Rodriguez was flown to Bolivia, where he spent months training Army Rangers in unconventional warfare techniques. By the first week of October, the CIA's network of assets had finally honed in on where Che Guevara was hiding out. He was holed up in the mountains in a remote village called La Higuera in Valgrande province. 2 days later, Rodriguez was installing an aircraft antenna in an airplane at the general headquarters of the 8th Division of the Bolivian Rangers when a coded message came over the radio. "Papa cansado," the message said. "Dad is tired." The Rangers, trained by Rodriguez, had captured Che Guevara alive. Rodriguez notified his CIA handler. That same night, President Johnson received a memo from National Security Advisor Walt Rostow saying that Che Guevara had likely been captured. "The Bolivian unit engaged is the one we have been training for some time," Rostow told the president. "This tentative information that the Bolivians got Che Guevara will interest you. It is not yet confirmed." In the morning, Felix Rodriguez and Bolivian Colonel Joaquin Zenteno Anaya flew by helicopter to the one-room schoolhouse in the mountains where Che was being held captive. Rodriguez asked to see the prisoner alone. Che Guevara was on the floor, his arms tied and his feet bound. His clothes were torn, his hair was matted, and in place of shoes, he wore pieces of leather tied with cord. There in the schoolhouse, with the prisoner looking on, Felix Rodriguez set up his radio and transmitted a coded message to the CIA station in La Paz, to be retransmitted on to headquarters at Langley in Virginia. Rodriguez photographed Che's diary and confiscated his belongings. Besides the diary, there were some pictures, Che's address book, and a roll of microfilm. Rodriguez says he spoke to Che alone for over an hour and that he told him he was Cuban and had been part of the CIA's Brigade 2506. "I said that in the aftermath of the CIA invasion at the Bay of Pigs, he had personally executed several of my friends." "Ha," Che said in response, nothing more. "I don't know what he was thinking at that moment, and I never asked," Rodriguez recalls. He says he told Che that he was working for the CIA and that the agency wanted him alive, not dead. Shots rang out in the room next door. A fighter named Aniceto had just been executed, and Rodriguez recalls hearing the man's body fall to the floor. Rodriguez received a radio call from the Bolivian High Command, he later told the CIA's Inspector General, with a coded message, the code numbers 500 and 600 as orders, to execute the prisoner Che Guevara. He knew that this was a violation of the Geneva Conventions. Rodriguez maintains that the Bolivian army was in charge of the operation, not the CIA. He stared at Che, a condemned man. We embraced, Rodriguez says. It was a tremendously emotional moment for me. I no longer hated him. Rodriguez walked out of the room, passing two Bolivian soldiers he says looked drunk. He asked them not to shoot Che Guevara in the face. He walked to a hilltop and stood there. When he heard shots ring out, he noted the time on his Rolex watch. It was 1:10 p.m. After a few minutes, one of the soldiers came out carrying Che Guevara's watch, a Rolex like his own. Rodriguez asked to see it. When the soldier wasn't looking, he says, he swapped out Che's Rolex for his own. It was time to move out. Using a canvas tarp, the soldiers loaded Che Guevara's body into the helicopter. But balancing the corpse inside the small helicopter was challenging, and a decision was made to strap the body to one of the helicopter's skids. Rodriguez struggled with the task. Looking down, he noticed he had Che Guevara's blood on his hands. Back at Bolivian Army headquarters, Felix Rodriguez briefed Chief of Staff General Alfredo Ovando Candia on the events of the day. At one point during the conversation, the general ordered a subordinate to cut off Che Guevara's hands, remembers Rodriguez. The hands were sent to Cuba, to Fidel Castro, as proof that Che was dead, Rodriguez stated in an interview for this book. I know for certain from sources that they are kept in preservatives in Havana, in a secure facility there. Rodriguez says that on occasion, Che's amputated hands are ceremoniously brought out and shown to anti-American revolutionaries as a physical reminder of the dirty work done by the United States and the Central Intelligence Agency. On February 24, 1969, Felix Rodriguez became a citizen of the United States. He told his CIA handler that he wanted to volunteer for U.S. government service in Vietnam. He was assigned to the Phoenix program, one of the most controversial programs of the Vietnam War. Phoenix was one of several pacification and rural security programs that CIA ran in South Vietnam during the 1960s, says Colonel Andrew R. Finlayson, an officer in the Phoenix program. The premise of pacification was that if peasants were persuaded that the government of South Vietnam and the United States were sincerely interested in protecting them from the Viet Cong, and trained them to defend themselves, then large areas of the South Vietnamese countryside could be secured or won back from the enemy without direct engagement by the U.S. military. This is not what happened. When so-called pacification was not realized, as the numbers of Viet Cong in the South went up as opposed to going down, the program was expanded. Whereas the Civilian Irregular Defense Group program focused on armed defense, the Phoenix program was intelligence-based. The CIA created a network of roughly 100 local intelligence committees across South Vietnam. These committees, says Colonel Finlayson, collected information on the Viet Cong and then disseminated it to local police. When this didn't work, the CIA-funded program became even more aggressive. Essentially, these committees created lists of known VCI, Viet Cong, operatives. Once the name, rank, and location of each individual VCI member became known, CIA paramilitary or South Vietnamese police or military forces interrogated these individuals for further intelligence on the communist structure and its operations. These CIA paramilitary teams were called Provincial Reconnaissance Units, PRUs. Felix Rodriguez was the deputy field advisor for the PRU in the village of Bien Hoa. His boss was a CIA officer named William Buckley, who, in due time, would become the central figure in President Ronald Reagan's decision to construct a foreign policy tool called preemptive neutralization. But that was far in the future. For now, every day with the PRU was about trying to quell the communist insurgency enveloping the South. Every field advisor assigned to a PRU paramilitary team worked undercover. Rodriguez's cover was that he was a civilian advisor for the U.S. Army. CIA internal memos described the provincial reconnaissance units as the investigatory and paramilitary attack teams that would support the Phoenix program in the field. Witnesses say that the program used torture, murder, and assassination to try to rid the South of the Viet Cong. U.S. officials have long disputed this claim. A similar program was developed in Afghanistan 40 years in the future. What would begin as a program of pacification in Afghanistan in September 2001 would be transformed into the first U.S. government targeted killing campaign to be publicly acknowledged by an American president.